Lightning Dogs, the official podcast presented by the Nerdist Show Network. Geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdist Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination. And with the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geek programming, visit nerdistshow.com. Lightning Dogs is conceived as an all-ages property, but these behind-the-scenes conversations are not all-ages. So listen at your own discretion, baby. Woo!
Sometimes a great idea is truly like a bolt of lightning. And sometimes, if you're lucky enough, you can capture the exact moment that it strikes. Well, that's what happened for us one fateful night while recording an episode of Nerdy Show. We accidentally launched a concept that derailed the entire show and, in no time, our lives. We couldn't stop talking about our favorite action figures and B-movies while twisting them into strange creatures, weird adventures, and dog puns. Lots of dog puns. This is the story of Lightning Dogs, a journey steeped in the glory of 80s and 90s animation and sci-fi, where anthropomorphic dogs tear through the wasteland of a ruined Earth, battling mutants, miscreants, and the evil Glampire. Coming soon to small screens, comic books, and podcasts. Or at least that's the goal. But how do you go from a crazy idea into a fully formed world of conflicting characters? How does a harebrained discussion become an animated series? That's what we're finding out firsthand. We've recorded the entire development of Lightning Dogs since day one, from the moment of conception to every world-building session and planning meeting, and the journey is still ongoing. Tune in as we create the world of the Lightning Dogs live!
Welcome to another episode of Lightning Dogs.
It was August of 2015, and for the first time ever, only two of us entered the studio. We make a point of recording every meeting for Lightning Dogs, and up to this point, it was always the three of us. Cap, Tony, and myself. Oh, this is Doug, by the way. Sometimes all of us meeting up could be a real challenge. If any of our work schedules got out of control, or something went sideways at the last minute for even one of us, then that could mean Lightning Dog's progress would stall for up to a week at a time. If a recording got canceled, we would always work independently on new ideas to bring to the table later, but our creativity thrives when we're collaborating. That's where this series comes from, and that's where we'd like to keep it, more often than not. As it happened, Cap and I were burning to talk about Lightning Dogs, and Tony was unavailable. So, in a pinch, we said, screw it. And for the first time, talked Lightning Dogs as a duo. It's not something we like to make a habit of, but since we're recording everything, anyone who misses out can always catch up later. In this episode, we're taking on the evil Glampire, an immortal alien stranded on Earth who's seen humanity rise and fall. He'll stop at nothing to get off this godforsaken mutant-infested rock, even if that means lording over the freaks of the wasteland. But what exactly are Glampire's powers? How much of a vampire is he really? And what role did he play in the destruction of humanity? We're going to confront all of that. But before we let our imaginations run wild, we did have some business to attend to. Looming on the horizon was the goal of completing both a story bible and a pitch bible for Lightning Dogs. Story bibles can be called show bibles or writer's guides, but they're all essentially the same thing. A formal document of the characters, tone, and all the key details of a fictional world to be used as reference for everything going forward. Meanwhile, the pitch bible is an extremely abbreviated version of a story bible, used to sell a show concept to an investor or a studio. It's the Lightning Dogs pitch bible that we'll be showing to Greg Wiseman, creator of Gargoyles and co-creator of Young Justice. We'll get his take on our overall concept and some advice as to whether or not we should jump right into pitching to networks or focus on launching Lightning Dogs as a fully independent project. To make sure we had a good handle on what to include and how to structure our bibles, Cap and I did some digging and found some inspiration in some unexpected places.
I did recently acquire a story bible for Disney's Doug, an original. Now, that's a whole conversation about the Disney years of Doug and the entire Doug production process and all the things that I learned when I accidentally went down a rabbit hole of a show that I liked but now have grown to absolutely love and know way too much about.
Welcome to Nerdy Show.
It's an amazing story bible, and the reason I tracked down the Doug story bible of all things is what you might not know from being a kid watching Doug is that it had one of the most complex, detailed story bibles or backgrounds in American animation, because the town of Bluffington was so detailed, they actually had a street map of the entire thing. They knew where any character was at any given point in time. Tons and tons of visual references and tons of information. So we've been studying that story Bible, the story Bible for Batman the Animated Series, the one that they put together going into season one, which we found a digital copy of. Visual references for story Bibles as well. Adventure Time, they haven't really released a story Bible, though a very, very early one is inside The Art of Ooh, which is a great reference for a lot of story building and character design. Great book. Batman Animated, which is a late 90s book made that compiles all the work for Batman the Animated Series. Before the Warner Brothers years, before the redesign.
We also have all the digital collections of all the other story Bibles of like Hero, Son of He-Man is one.
Really? I haven't seen that one.
Yeah. I don't know if the show ever actually existed.
I'm not sure it did, but I mean, it makes as much sense as like Tabitha, the right. spinoff of Bewitched.
Yeah, we did. We also got digital story Bibles for Star Trek Next Generation, Star Trek Voyager. I have the original pitch for Star Trek, the original series, which is interesting. Just the one thing, we just started talking about all these different story Bibles and like how to best organize it. There's no rule. I mean, there's no standard guideline. No. All of them are so different. And it's like trying to pick and choose your favorite things between each one has been difficult, but inspiring at the same time.
I do love them. I love how simple they are. We actually found a story Bible for Mighty Max online.
Ah, yes.
It was on a forum. Someone had
transcribed it, basically.
Yeah, I guess. And hats off to you.
Yeah.
Like, thank you. It's great. I loved reading it. And, you know, these story Bibles, they remind me of how comic scripts are written for comic books, because there's no set format. It's a communication between the script writer and the artist, and hopefully they have a rapport so they can have a more dynamic relationship.
But there's expectations. Like, you expect to have a breakdown of individual characters of the main characters.
Yeah.
You expect, especially in an animation, you expect some drawings of said characters. You want to see what the look of the world is like, especially if it's a fantasy world or a science fiction. You definitely want tone in terms of some of these images. I mean, like, Batman's a fucking great example of that, where it's just, within two images, you know what the show's going to look like. It leaves no question.
Yeah. And with Mighty Max, the thing that I latched onto the most was the opening page of like, what's this show about? Yeah. And it's so bombastic. It's so enthusiastic. There's nothing analytical or even like Wikipedia about its nature at all.
Yeah, it's not like it's trying to pitch you a show as much as it's like, listen to this crazy idea someone told me and I'm going to repeat it to you, but ain't this shit crazy? And it's self-referential, but not like annoying. And I don't know.
And it was an adult talking to other adults. And so it wasn't shying away from, say, like cuss words and so on.
It's like other people might run and hide, but Max, no, man, he ain't got time for that crap. He's our hero. Like, so it's, at the same time, it's acknowledging that it's a story that they're telling you, but not like a narrative where it's like, let me tell you the story of Mighty Max and how badass he is. But rather, like, it knows it's pitching it to be a show. It knows it's pitching it to people who may be holding the money to it and aren't that creative people, but it's just trying to get you hyped.
Yeah,
it's trying to get you pumped.
And it also contained the hype and the energy that
should be imbued
in the show itself. And you can, I mean, just from that first page, I'd be like, this is exactly the show they made.
Yeah.
Like, this energy, the mystery, everything that happens in this first page happened in the show.
And that's just text on the page without images.
Yeah. We have no idea if there was any accompanying images to any of this. I love that. I love the shorthand of just being really casual about the presentation. And of course, we can do that with Lightning Dogs. We've been doing it like since day one. We just got to never let ourselves get bogged down in the minutia of the world we've created, because we were doing all this extra work. We're setting out to create a more complicated story Bible than most would have at a first season. So we also have to be careful, because we do want to bring on additional writers. We want to make this something that's accessible and people feel like they have the room to be creative in. But we also want to know that there's direction, that we have at least bullet points far enough out, and that we as creators feel comfortable having built a scaffolding to make those bullet points make sense. And so far as like story beats, elements about the world. I mean, if you look at the timeline for Domus, you'll say, well, wow, you guys got this whole thing figured out. But nah, hell nah. Any one of these single bullet points could inspire a completely unique series. We wanted to keep it open. This isn't constraints. This is possibilities.
Reading all these Bibles and discovering how freeform the format was has been empowering and inspiring. We'll have a link to where you can read the publicly available Bibles and pitches on this episode's page. Once we've got final versions of our own pitch and story Bibles to share, you're going to see them. And as they're being assembled, you'll see them first on the Lightning Dogs Patreon. Patreon is also a key piece of the puzzle when it comes to Greg Wiseman reviewing our Bible. He's a big name, and he can't do it for free, so we need to raise at least $1,000 for the minimum time needed to work with him and get his sage-like advice.
Every dollar helps, so if you want to see this project come to fruition as much as we do, please consider joining us at patreon.com/lightningdogs. But back to Cap and I's discussion. From this point, it wasn't long before our conversation veered sharply into world-building territory, and we abruptly found ourselves discussing Earth just before the fall of humanity. It was a hopeful era for mankind, highlighted by the construction of a massive object in orbit, a crystal-powered gate to the stars built under the supervision of Glampire. His determination to return to his homeworld was his undoing, and Earth's as well.
So let's talk about the satellite a little bit, or whatever it is, the crystal array, because I feel like it's a good enough time as any to try to nip in the bud exactly what it was that we're working towards in that regard. I love the visual of something space station-sized.
A gate in the sky.
Let's say a Mass Effect relay.
Yeah.
You know, in orbit above Earth. I love that visual of that, you know, crashing down. My concern goes to the progression of technology and how likely it was they'd be able to build something so big without it having another purpose. Because if Glampire's like, I'm gonna rush the process of making a gate to the stars, that's great. I believe he wants to do that, but he's gotta play within the confines of the rest of humanity and what they believe that he's doing.
Well, humanity doesn't even need to know that he exists.
Well,
the upper people will know. Like, the average person on the street.
Right. I mean, like, Glampire's not Elon Musk. He's not, like, a celebrity.
He's not a public figure.
But you would find him in some journals, some business journals. Like, I don't think he's, like, 100% in the shadows. He's, like, a more reclusive Elon Musk. He's the Elon Musk you don't know about.
Almost like the Walton family of, like, Walmart. They're off on their own. We don't really know much about their private lives. They have ungodly amounts of money stored away somewhere, and they just do what they do. They're not here to be known by the people. They own a business.
Right. So whatever Glampire's alias is, whatever he's going by, you can find records of him. Mm-hmm. No problem.
Probably has several aliases.
Yeah. Could even be. He's definitely got corporations within corporations and whatever else. But basically, we have to create a world in which the following things are true. That the facility that the Lightning Dogs teleport to via the Farfetch is off the grid enough Glampire doesn't even know about it. Mm-hmm. It's not there. That there are so few of them that most of these facilities would be either like well fortified or subterranean or something. They're so experimental that they don't exist. You know, he doesn't even know about them. Like, we have to figure out a way for Glampire to have both influenced all this so that we have that tragedy aspect of it, and then also to have a situation where he wouldn't know about things. Because otherwise, if they were doing stuff off world, he would know about it.
Right.
So what's he trying to do? What are we...
Well, you bring up a good question, because people of Earth would know they're built that, hey, we've made it. We've made it to the stars. We have a technology that allows us to go to other planets. It's still very difficult. It's still very energy consuming. So we're doing it really small, but we have done it. And the whole world probably knows.
Right.
So then you're like, okay, well then how many gates are there? I mean, everyone knows about the ISS, you know, like everybody knows exactly like what we're working with. So,
well, unless we're talking about a world where privatized space travel and corporations and those entities do have the ability to operate these things in secret. For example, like if they've got the crystals, if they're concerned with the production of crystals, they want to keep this revolution to themselves until they've perfected it. So it's unlikely. It's just
they think they perfected it when they're building a giant space station that will launch you across the galaxy. Right. So I think either way, when things go wrong, the public knows this technology exists.
Have you seen The Man Who Fell to Earth?
No.
Okay. It's very much an art film sci-fi. It's very long and very weird, but a lot of the stuff that I'm getting the influence for Glampire as this industrialist is a sidestep, and I mentioned this before, but it's a sidestep to the narrative in The Man Who Fell to Earth, who is an alien who is from a planet without water, who's come to Earth to seek out water, gets sidetracked by his own hangups and humanity and everything, becomes a wealthy, reclusive, strange industrialist, and starts funding like space experiments and so on. Mm-hmm. And it's all over the place. The movie's all over the place, but there's no real resolution to the sci-fi aspects of it. I feel like we're taking that trope and doing something exciting and different with it. Granted, it was a book first, which I have not read, which may be more of a real
probably
sci-fi.
Probably explains it a bit more.
Yeah, probably. I like that trope. I want to play with that trope. I think it makes Glampire a more interesting figure to have had him actually have a hand in the downfall of Earth. It looks like it's humanity's folly, but it's his folly, and that's a regret that he can hold on to fuel his rage.
I thought of it more of like this amazing secret backstory that the Lightning Dogs don't know. But Glampire would almost find it funny that they come here looking for masters and he knows everything. He knows humans better than we know ourselves at this point.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
And for them to just be so confused and to have no idea, they're just stumbling along and these ignorance that they just have of who they think are gods. And at any point, he could just sit them down and be like, let me crush your hopes and dreams just by speaking the truth. I don't even have to lie to you. You know, like there's a really interesting thing about that. And building to a point where it's like, I don't think this will ever happen. But if you were to have Glampire sit down with the Lightning Dogs and start telling them the story, and let's just assume they believe everything he's saying, then becomes the great twist, like Scar from The Lion King, like, and here's my little secret. I killed Mufasa. And then you're like, fuck! It's like that he was literally the one who pushed humanity to the brink, in one way inspired them, and in one way, you know, helped fund them to do this, and they things were better than ever, but he just had to go home. He just had to do his own thing, and that just was too much, and humanity suffered because of it. But he's kind of like, eh, fuck him anyway. Like, you know, it's like, yeah, it failed, and now I'm really pissed off, and it didn't work, but I'll figure out another way, and you're going to help me do it.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's really, I love that. I love how powerful that is and how much we can play with that, because that information, you know, it's old hat to us, but...
Right. I mean if you think of a newcomer, if you're just watching like the pilot episode and you see the Glampire, you don't know what he knows. You don't know that he's been around for forever. That'd be a great twist. You'd have them maybe someday in the future, if they're talking to the artificial intelligent robots in Antarctica or wherever they are, and it's like, oh, you have records of the past. Let's see. And then like they start learning this a little bit more and more and more about how humanity was building and building and building. And they're like, oh, they found the crystals just like us. And oh my gosh, look at how like us. They didn't have a war with crystals when they found out about them. You know, they're better than us, aren't they? Well, you know, like they're admiring it almost. And then you just have a flashback episode where it's like you just see this backstory and they're like, oh well, Major Tom, prepare to meet your benefactor. This is the man who's built the space capsule you're gonna be flying in. You pan the camera over and it's Glampire in a modern day business suit. It's like, yes, pleased to meet you, finally I handpicked you myself, you know, all these just the and if you don't know that going in, you'd be like, oh my fucking god, like you didn't even know he was immortal, you didn't even know that he was alive that long. Yeah, you had no clue.
And even still, like, we could have pictures of Glampire in like a fedora with sunglasses on in a suit. You wouldn't fucking recognize him.
Yeah.
And you could have him in the background of things. Who knows how long we could seed in images of him without anybody having a chance in hell of noticing him until finally, like, you know, you get the big picture at one point. It'd be great.
It's like...
That's Devil's haircut.
Yeah. No, really. That's kind of how I picture it going on, where it's just like, oh, shit, he was there the entire time and they didn't even fucking know. It just... To us, it's an exciting idea, but we don't even get to experience the revelation of it. Other people going into it who don't know,
That's the goal. That's the hope. Yeah. That's what we're striving for.
Yeah. Maybe now is a decent time we can start digging into, what is he? Like, what is Glampire? Obviously, he's an alien from another planet, but we've talked before very briefly about what his powers or lack thereof may not be.
People are asking on the forums. They got questions, and it's kind of crazy that we haven't answered this yet. Yeah. I suppose what's important is, thus so far, we have a likable group of main characters, and we know the bad guy is evil, which is the most important thing you can have for something of the genre we're creating.
And kind of ageless.
Yeah.
So he's ageless and from another planet, has a knowledge of futuristic devices, alien technology, if you will.
Now, I would say he's most assuredly a vampire in some respects.
I mean, obviously that's in the name, but what is it? I mean, I don't know if he should fly. Should he fly?
I don't think he should fly, but I do think standard issue vampire stuff, and that he's like relatively impervious, stronger than he looks.
Yes.
And that he has some kind of life leeching abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Are they the cliche bite the neck, suck the blood kind of things? I'm not attached to that.
Yeah. What if it's
should
kind
he
of
have
like
fangs? I think he should have fangs.
Fangs would be a great visual, but then you expect him to bite somebody. Something to consider. I mean, he's an alien after all, but in terms of the life sucking ability, could that be some way related to the kid's ability? The opposite side of the coin? Like, kid can suck the energy out of crystals and transfer energy. Or do you see Glampire being more like Rogue from X-Men?
Rogue is all about power transferal, and she can actually absorb everything about somebody to a point of death, leaving it as a wilted husk. And I think that part of her, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't mean power transference necessarily. Right. I just meant more of like it can literally suck the life out of you.
Glampire has the ability to, let's say via his hands, feed, and this is how he sustains himself, to feed off the life force of other creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And they wither. They don't grow old. in like rogue stuff or like life absorbing stuff. Like, well, it looks like, you know, you have a young kid and they turn into an old man. Now maybe they get wrinkly or they compress.
Yeah,
they
don't really I'm thinking less like, oh, you age, and now you're suddenly like 50 years older, as so much as it mummifies you.
Yeah, you turn to a husk.
Yeah.
Does he drain your vitals in a way that you could recover from? I want to lean towards something that's actually like medically sound, of like, he drains your vitals.
Yeah, because he's not magic.
It's not like he shaved years off of your life. But that could happen, you know, if the cell damage was so extreme,
like,
or
the
whatever.
Pit of despair from Princess Bride.
I mean, and maybe we could, you know, throw around wording like that if someone really got it bad, you know, like practically a husk. Oh my God, no, there's still a pulse. And they're like, well, yeah, you know, we're pumping fluids into you, but you're going to have white hair now.
I want it to be a little believable. I mean, just a little bit, in the sense that, like, if he touches you and it's instant death, maybe that's a power that he can control. Like, it's not automatic. If he gets really angry, he could pick up, like, one of the little creatures that serves him out of anger and just, like, squeeze its head, and you just see, and it shrivels, and it's done. And in about 5 seconds, and he's just like, ugh, like, you know. And that's not even pure out of anger, but it could also mean that he's just running low on energy and he just needed it. But if you're, like, say, fighting him and he punches you, I don't think you should fall down dead and turn into a mummy.
Yeah, no. I feel like it's the palms of his hands. Like,
yeah.
Imagine, like, pores opening up and absorbing. But I don't want to be a parasite, you know, yeah. Like, from Superman. I don't want to be, like, a leech creature, exactly.
Right.
But it kind of neat to have, like, weird patterns on the palms of his hands or something like that. Like, something where you could...
Especially if he wears gloves a lot. That,
yeah,
can be kind of freaky.
That could
just
be
like,
really,
he takes the gloves off for the first time, and you just see this weird, ripply, like, almost gill-like thing, and you're just like, what the fuck is that?
Or, you know, maybe he doesn't wear them in the Lightning Dog's present, but he certainly did in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to see, you know, him having a kind of vampiric embrace, grabbing someone, absorbing their energy. Maybe there's some kind of a funky, you know, light show, as you do in fiction, glowing eyes, you know, that kind of thing. But what other powers do we want to have? Because he's the ruler of this entire land.
He already has a lot of power.
Right, he has a lot of power. Right. But is his reputation and influence and relative indestructibility enough? Or does he need to have some, like, when you throw down with Glampire, like when you do battle with Glampire, what are you up against?
I think we talked about before in earlier episodes that he kind of may have, like, a mind control ability, like, or an influence ability. Kind of like going sort of back to a vampiric,
yeah,
thing, where Bela Lugosi would, you know, give you a look, stare with the eyes when he was Dracula, and you would just, your arms would go limp, and you are then open to any suggestion. And he would turn people against themselves and just make you a servant. To the point where you could have this husk of a person, you don't even hurt them. You're under his spell, and he would say, go do this. And then when they go out into public to get whatever he wants, they're acting totally normal, but still under his control.
We really need to work with this. Yeah, because where does his weird cartoon name come from? Why does everybody in the wasteland refer to him as Glampire? That's so on the nose.
Mm.
That's so weird. It may be that he's been doing the wealthy industrialist shtick for a while. Throughout history, he's had to wear a lot of different hats.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is too on the nose, but, like, maybe he did actually participate in the glam rock circuit. Like, he was a figure.
I've thought about that, but I think the more we put him in the public eye, it just becomes almost too obvious. Like, he was also a rock star.
Right.
There is a version of that works. I just don't know if it's, oh, and then he's going to go on to become a millionaire. Like, once you become a rock star, even if you're old and it's like 30 years later and your music's not popular anymore.
Well, no, you fake your death. Eddie and the Cruisers.
Yeah, but, you know, it's just now that just adds a level of complexity. Now it's like, well, if he's going to fake his death, why did he even do it in the first place? Whereas if it's just like his goal, because he knows, because here's the other thing. He is an alien on a different planet. And if he comes under too close a scrutiny, they're going to find out.
Right.
And although he may have some powers, this is a world that will not understand.
Sure.
It would react very harshly.
I think it's a really great environment for that, because it is really heavy-handed, but I would like to make it work for the sole reason of, if we do give him the manipulation powers, it's great because it works with the Diamond Dogs and that whole process.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would be able to orchestrate that. It's something that would come naturally to him to create creatures like that and to lord over what was left, because what does he have left but his abilities to manipulate and his invulnerability, though we do need to give him a weakness that's not sunlight. And if he was in a position where, let's say, he glitters or something, not in a Twilight kind of way, but like the thrall of Glampire is a beautiful experience.
Yeah. You don't, almost like you don't want to hurt him.
Right. And when Glampire's feeding, it's immensely pleasurable for him. Like, it's the best. It's not because he doesn't eat in a conventional sense as we understand it. Like, absorption is different. So then that pleasurable thing is kind of circuitous.
More of a drug as opposed to sustenance.
Right. But his thrall is even more drug-like. Like, he gets, like, say, like, immediate pleasure. Like, let's say a comparison to, like, sexual pleasure from absorbing that life force. It's overwhelming. It makes him feel so good.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to do it, and he wants to do it. But when you're in Glampire's thrall, it's a magical experience. And you can't come out of it. You have to come down from it. Like, you'll fight
pulling somebody.
Right, yes. And even if you're pulling somebody away from that influence or something, they'll still fight you because it felt so good. It was so good. It'll stick with you. Like, it's dangerous to be in his thrall.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in my mind, a wonderful visual to think of, like, 70s era glam and, you know, sparkles, glitter effects, and like in all those great 70s, like, cheesy kind of camera tricks and so on.
Borderline gem. You know, just
proto gem.
Yeah.
And to have a guy at the center of it, that's a visual representation of the thrall that he is, in fact, projecting.
Like, I feel like in every Japanese anime, when the young girl looks over at Senpai, that effect. Like, when it cuts to the face of the androgynous male that the crush is on, and it just plays that twinkling sound, and it has that diffused glow effect to it. That's what you see when you're in Glampire's presence for a little too long.
If you think about his timeline, getting here in the early days of humanity...
You know, I'm going to have to bring up a Star Wars tangent.
Sure.
Because this is sounding similar to Prince Zizor.
I never
say it right. And I've heard it pronounced several different ways, from the audiobook to the way it's supposed to be pronounced on toy packaging. I don't know. But Zizor? As a kid, I said Zizor. But anyway, whatever.
Pheromone dude.
Pheromone dude. Yeah, tried to seduce Princess Leia, almost did it, and Chewie saved her.
Which I hate that whole storyline. I've been pretty...
Right, for Star Wars, I can understand. But this is a similar guy.
For Star Wars.
Yeah.
It was wrong. It was dirty. It was dirty fan fiction that got published.
But this is something similar to what we got with Glampire, where you have a guy, mysterious member of a race who's either missing or all dead, is seeking revenge of some kind, is a powerful head of a large, basically, army of weirdos. He has his own gang.
Yeah.
So and he rivals with the Hutt clan and rivals with whatever, and he's trying to sort of grease the palms of the emperor to get in his good graces so that maybe one day he can kill the emperor. And he has these powers of suggestion and influence and everything else, and he's very exotic, and he dresses in these fancy clothes, and he lives in luxury, even though the rest of the universe is kind of all shitty. So there's similarities there, but with him, it was more of a personal revenge against Vader and like a very clear plot to overthrow the Empire and just become badass of the galaxy. We don't really know that aspect of it for Glampire, for trying to get home, because right now he just wants to get off this shithole of a planet that he's stuck on.
Yeah.
But there's something there as far as a comparison, like in terms of how he's handled.
Yeah, no.
It's biology, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like a crystal influence or whatever.
I mean, imagine on his home planet, they've got crystal technology. It's common enough that he, at least as someone for whose field it is not, that he could figure out, like, well, what is it going to take for me to steer humanity into a way so that their experts could develop this technology?
Right.
Like, he's not a dumb guy.
It's like, if I went back in time, I know enough about the most basic shit where if I could invest in the stock market, like if you send me back to 1954 and you give me like $10 and I go and I just get a job working at some cafe or a gas station or whatever, so I'm making nothing, but I take every cent that I have to spare and I invest it in IBM, in a few years, I'm going to become really rich. Like, I can see where things are going to go.
Well, I would say it's more of a comparison of, like, say you know how light bulbs work and you get thrown into medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're working with.
Right. I was building to that point, but just basically, like, the idea, because clearly he doesn't know what the humanity's future is.
Right.
But he has a good idea. Like, he may, like, I don't want to say he's an average person on the other planet, because it's clearly some kind of, like, General Zod.
He was a revolutionary of some kind.
Yeah.
He knew enough.
He wanted to overthrow, didn't happen, and he's sent here as punishment.
On his home planet, they sustain themselves by absorbing living creatures. You know, we have our meat factories.
Food, yeah.
We could think about, like, ways where, well, oh no, they've tried to be peaceful or something. That's a story for another day. But the point is, biologically speaking, he does that. The point of the thrall would likely be as a natural order kind of thing. Like, that's how they get their food. So they have a whole culture that's based on cunning, guile, manipulation, and so on, because that's biologically the nature of him, unless he is a freak on his own world.
Mm-hmm. Which I don't particularly...
No. That's problematic.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's more interesting that he's power-wise, he's basically the same. Just ideologically, he was kicked off for trying to overthrow a government or start a revolution of some kind.
Right.
But on Earth, I'm kind of digging the idea that him consuming life is a little of a slower process. Like, the bigger you are, the slower the process would be. For example, once Cane Corso is under his control, it's like he can just go over and touch Cane Corso every now and then, just when he starts to lose the faith a bit, just to be kind of like, oh no, I think you need to do whatever, you know, and then it's like he starts feeling good, then Cane Corso starts feeling pretty good. It's a longer, drawn-out process. You almost would think it's like more like Stockholm Syndrome, but for him to just live, it could be really simple. They can bring him any piece of crap off the wasteland, like any slug, any frog the size of a dog. I don't want it to be like, bring me a beautiful girl and I have to feed off of her like a vampire would want to or whatever. I think it to make it more in a realistic way, it's like it can be anything. And just like, if even if it's just something like Jabba the Hutt eating the frog or whatever, if it's just something small, it's just like, all right, I'm fine now. And well, not even
and that was an appetizer. That wasn't his meal.
Right. But you know what I'm saying? It's like but a bunch of little things all together. Yeah, he'll have a whole meal. He could eat grubs because he doesn't care. He's like, he's living in the lap of luxury.
I would imagine that like the energies of different creatures, be they plants or animals or whatever, all have a different experience. There's ones that he prefers.
Right.
And that the act of absorbing in its own way, it's replenishing, but maybe it's also like, you know, exhausting. Like he has to, if he wanted to kill somebody by absorbing them, he would have to exert himself a great deal. Like say if we talk about it as a parallel for sex.
Well, you know, I'm realizing, I'm not trying to interrupt your train of thought, but you were hitting on something that is definitely out of Mass Effect as well. Like out of the,
wait, really?
Yeah.
I only played the first one. I know I lose a lot of credibility with that.
Oh, no, dude, the first one's great, but I think they're all great. But in the second one, you meet up with other Asari. There's an Asari Justicar who the side quest mission is you have to go find her daughter. She's like, but I got to warn you, she's an Ardat Yakshi. And you're like, what the fuck is that? And it's like, oh, well, every once in a while, an Asari is born with these extreme out of control powers and they can't handle it. And they run amok and they try to do the mind meld, you know, embrace eternity thing. And it literally kills you. It's just like your brain can't, you have a brain hemorrhage, your heart attack, your heart explodes, like all of it all at the same time. And it just drains the life out of you. But that is an addictive thing for an Ardat Yakshi who can't train themselves to resist it. And her daughter has basically escaped the compound where they keep her, sort of like a monk temple of where they take all these young Asari and try to train them to use the power for good and not, you know, become greedy and start eating people.
Uh-huh.
But she's gone rogue. She starts eating people. She's like a serial killer that is untraceable. And everyone falls in love with her because of their, you know, Asari or like the baseline level of attractive that any alien species can relate to. Yeah. So she like prowls in clubs on different planets and stuff. And you got to go in, pretend to be seduced by her and then get the drop on her.
Yeah, no, that sounds exactly like what I'm
saying. Yeah, but you got to. But when you're playing as Commander Shepard, you got to be like, resist it actually, because it does start to have an effect on you and you have to make a choice. You are going to either kill her and finish that plan of what the mother wants, or kill the mother and have her on your team. And she's,
how long does that work for?
What, having her on your team as a serial killer? She says she'll rein it in, and she says she'll do it, and you can. That's a legit option. Well, you can do
all the way to the end of Mass Effect 3.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware.
Holy shit, I had no idea. How has no one ever talked to me about this character? That sounds crazy.
She's a psycho, borderline serial killer, you know.
She must not be a popular selection then, because I've never heard anybody talk about her.
Well, no, because it's creepy. You know, it's like, I mean, she's legit creepy.
God, yeah, I guess if everybody wasn't so into Tali,
there's a mode where you can play, because here's the thing, right? The Asari Justicar, that's her team, Morinth. She's like, and it's sad and it's terrible, but I have to kill my daughter because she's killed so many people and she'll kill again. And it's my job as a Justicar, basically a space cop, you know, to put her down, you know, and it's awful. It's like this gut wrenching thing, you know, and you're going to help her make that decision. You're going to help her take her down. But when she gives you the sexy eyes, and basically it's like a terrible analogy, but it's like Anakin Skywalker with Windu and Palpatine in the window, like, you must choose, you know, like, what are you going to do? They're both fighting using their Asari powers.
Ugh.
And if you choose,
you're making me sick even mentioning that scene.
Yeah,
fuck
and,
you.
And if you choose to side with the daughter instead of the mother dies, and the daughter is just like, well, you know, your crew is gonna want to know what happened to her because they know that you're after me, this crazy serial killer. So I'm just gonna wear her outfit, and no one's gonna know the difference because the Asari look too similar for most people. So she just puts on the mom's outfit and then just goes by her name in public. But when you're in private, it goes back to her name. And
oh
there's, and oh no, this is the point I'm getting to. There's a choice in the game where, so you can choose to romance her.
Uh-huh.
And if you decide to romance her, she's like, listen,
just a path to a game over.
It's just a path to a game over where she just says, listen, if you want to pursue it, we can pursue it. But I'm telling you, no one can resist it. And no one can handle it. And you're like, I'm Commander Shepard. You know, I can do anything. And she's just like, no, really, like, I'll do this if you want. But I'm telling you, you're going to die. And the game, in a weird way, if you've already gone this far, you're thinking, I can do it. I mean, yeah, come on. I could do this. I'm Commander Shepard. I can do anything. I can survive making out with her because, you know, otherwise the game would just be over instantaneously. You click the option. He's like, I'm willing to take that risk. And then just, boom, they embrace. And she's like, embrace eternity. And then cut to a game over screen. And then that's it. You got to start back over your last save. And it's like, I think it's fucking great that they give you that option.
Yeah.
This has been an interesting tangent. But I only bring it up to mention it in detail because this is a level of power that we're talking about with Glampire. Similar sort of.
Yeah, well, what I was saying, basically, the dude, if he wants to consume an entire adult life force, he will have to really exert himself. Like, the channels will be open. He will be using his equivalent Kegel muscles.
Yeah. And they even say, she's just like, you know, when he's like, what's it like when you kill somebody? Are they in pain? Are they in whatever? And she goes, it is the most euphoric experience that one can experience in the universe. Like, it's like,
yes,
before death, it is literally the highest of all highs.
Let's say, it is for Glampire.
Yeah.
If he's taking the time to put you in his thrall, otherwise, I would wager it's a very painful and awful experience.
If it kills you.
Yeah, because if he's like, no, this is chill, you're chill, I'm chill, let me sip off you for a while.
Yeah.
Right, you're good, everything's great.
But if he decides to empty you, if you're like, take me, Glampire, he's like, all right, your funeral.
Well,
and then
what I'm talking about is like the lightning dogs are in there, like Dingo, he's like, you. Like, he lunges at him.
And you're not under his spell.
Right, you're not under his spell. He doesn't give a fuck about you. He's just sucking dry.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not getting anything. There's no padding. There's no cushion. It's
right.
White hot terror.
It's like he has to condition you before you become food.
Right.
If you have a brain, at least. If you're a mindless creature, then it doesn't
matter. And his race was all like, well, you know, like, you're a rabbit equivalent. Come over here. And Rabbit's like, oh, yeah, sure, I could do that. And he's like, well, sorry, pal. Which isn't to say that they don't have pets. It's just to say that, you know, like, they can get a pet very easily. The trick is not eating that pet. That's the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got Thrall, a vampiric embrace, super strength, no flight, though I would love to see him do kind of like weird leaps that look like a guy on wires.
Yeah, leaping's not that bad. Yeah.
Like, that's something you do with strength.
Like Khan from Into Darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Glowy eyes when necessary, but energy blasts, dealing back someone's life force at them or something. I don't know if that's...
I don't know about that. Yeah, that seems a little too magical and not really.
But you know what? He's a guy with a lot of powers at his disposal, as in, like, forces and so on. So we should probably give him a creepy scientist character. You know, like, oh, okay, well, I've got these crystal gauntlets or whatever. Like, you know, energy blast, slicing, I don't know, whatever. Mm-hmm. If we want to have an action figure where everybody's got... Like,
is it Renfield in the in Dracula? We need that character. We need a surrogate for that. The guy's just like, Master, I've completed the newest invention. It's like,
no. Two on the nose.
I don't mean literally take that voice. I'm just saying. It's like that role needs to be filled somehow by somebody. Isn't that what Nagel is kind of doing?
Well, Nagel is like...
He's a robot.
Yeah, he's like his assistant. He's like a page or a butler. He's an alarm system. He's his Alfred, you know? But he's not the guy who's designing stuff necessarily. I feel like Nagel's...
You said he's his Alfred, but he's not building or designing anything, and that is what Alfred does.
No. Like, it depends on what continuity you're talking about. Alfred is a capable right-hand person who can, like, look unassuming and then take you down. Alfred takes care of business, but I said in most continuities, Alfred is just
a butler, yeah.
Like, there's other continuities where he's got that weird deformed dude...
That always creeped me out.
I couldn't even tell you where that guy fits into any respective continuity. It's like, he's there, he isn't there, whatever. But it's kind of like, you know, in Power Rangers, the original Power Rangers.
Aye, aye, aye.
not Alpha. I actually wasn't thinking about Alpha. But yes, if Glampire is Zordon, then Nagel's his Alpha. But I was talking about Rita Repulsa, and she's got that dude who makes the little clay sculptures that they send out. I'm not talking about we have something as formulaic as the anime plots that are Power Rangers or whatever. Like, every episode is the same but slightly different. But a guy who's like tinkering, tinkerer.
Glamfire's not out there getting his hands dirty.
No.
Who's doing the dirty work?
Who are the science people? Who are the people who's like, well, like, how about try this with the crystals? Where did the glass spiders come from? Like, probably, Glamfire working alongside somebody else. What are those even? We don't even know. I've talked about Glamfire's entourage, like the need for dukes and so on of different lands and everything. And I want him to have basically a situation where he's Frankenfurter and there's rich weirdos up in the eaves and you don't know who they are. You don't know what they are. They've all probably got weird stories and maybe we'll focus on them someday. But he's in a castle and this castle is going to be populated with things and people that are also things.
I'm just a hot Glamfire from glamorous glam rock.
Oh, right. So that which reminds me. So Glamfire's been living with humanity for a long time. It's like he's Bill Murray in Groundhog's Day, but time is progressing, but there's no consequences. He just lives forever and ever and ever and has enough power that he can work with any kind of indulgence and mostly like humanity's ants. He doesn't necessarily want to be the emperor, but he'll whisper in somebody's ear to, like, you know, to have his way and so on and so forth.
Well, it's also because he's aware that if he decided to conquer the world in the ancient world, eventually he'd be overthrown and killed because he'd be exposed as a freak.
He doesn't want to be god of the ants.
Right.
You know, whatever he was doing on his own planet, that was important to him. That was really important to him. And being god of the ants means nothing. He lives comfortably. Sure. Fine. Whatever. So technology's marching on, and he's like, well, you know, we might be getting close here, but he's already kind of like, it's a wild, funky time.
Could Earth be sort of like a mobile game, like Tiny Tower or Fallout Shelter, where it's just like, oh, more people died. Ah, well. You know, you're trying to build something. Your end goal is to get enough stuff put together that you can finally make something real.
Right, like, you know, Doctor Who, the thing's like, well, I love my companions because they're only here for a short while and then like a flame, they burn out or whatever like that. Well, Glamfire takes the opposite look at immortality. He's like, well, why even bother?
Yeah.
Doctor Who's like, oh, I'm such a bleeding heart all the time. And Glampire's like, well, that's your mistake there. These things, why are you even giving a damn about?
They're so primitive.
Yeah.
I mean, we're primitive.
Which is probably, that's probably kind of, if we're doing a Doctor Who comparison, that's probably where the Master falls into that. But imagine, if you will, 20th century. He's like, well, there could be something here, but it's been a weird time for him. There's been all these world wars and everything. It's kind of destabilized. And he's like, well, I've been keeping a low profile. I've just been kind of waiting for a while. And he does the glam rock thing. Like, he pays some people to write some songs, or maybe he himself is a really good songwriter or whatever. And he's there for a while, but then something happens. Something happens. He sees something. He's in this drug haze of all the people that he's with, and they all seem all sleepy and weird and all because of all the 1970s drugs they're on, which is actually Glamfire.
Mm-hmm.
There's not enough needles around here for as high as everybody seems to be.
Right.
But he sees something. He's like, he's always reading science journals, which is like so far out, man. And he sees that there's been a breakthrough. It's really casual. He's been doing this all along, you know, monitoring stuff and everything. And then he's like, oh my God, he's been lackadaisical about the whole thing.
Because he's waiting.
Right.
He's waiting for the first computer, you know, he's waiting for humanity on its own to reach a point where he can say, now I can nudge them in the right direction.
Right. And he's maybe been nudging them in different places or like investing money in things and so on. But it only goes so far because you can't say to a primitive race, OK, I want you to invent a crystal that can do this, this and this. And they're like, that's not how it works, man. So he finally sees something for the first time in forever. That he's like, oh, my God, I can work with this. They've finally done it. And that's the day, or, you know, several days after, top 20 artist Glamfire dies, drives off of a bridge and, you know, disappears or whatever. Like,
I see what you're saying. I'm not 100% against it. I just feel like I can't picture General Zod doing that if he's on another planet. Granted, General Zod has the powers of like Superman, depending on what version we're going with.
And he doesn't live forever.
But I'm having a hard time picturing like another alien who's just like on this other planet, stuck here, doesn't really care about the people. If he doesn't care about the people, then why did he become a rock star?
What I'm looking for is, one, I like the visual of it, but two, I'm looking for a good excuse for him to have a goofy name that carries over into what is for the Lightning Dogs present day.
For just the name Glamfire?
Right. I don't know, what the fuck do people call him?
Lord.
Lord Glamfire.
Yeah. You Master. Know? I mean, they call
I suppose I'm overthinking it. They'd be like, well, they call him the Glamfire on account of, you know, he's what like he a, does. He,
yeah.
Like, we've literally
if
given
word,
him,
if the word glam is somehow involved in his home planet, then why the fuck not?
He has glamour powers and he has vampiric powers. He is literally a glampire.
He's a glamorous vampire.
So, I guess, I don't know. If we're on the fence about it, we should kick it around a little bit more. Like, I like the trope of it. And we've talked about how we don't want to borrow too much from Bowie. And giving him a David Bowie period is
a little too close to home is the thing.
It is, but I do love it. And I almost feel like as soon as we talked about that he was immortal and everything, I almost feel like it was expected.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that part of his backstory is so far down the line.
It's true.
We can decide to throw it in or take it out depending on the direction the whole series is going.
I mean, in the story Bible, for example, to tie it
doesn't
back
even
around.
Matter. Yeah, it doesn't even
all
matter.
All I would say is Glampire comes from another planet and has enslaved Earth. He's been with humanity a long time. And basically,
he's the only one. The most important thing about him is that he's the number one adversary because he's trying to get off of Earth, yeah. And he's the only person on Earth who remembers what human beings were like.
It'll tell you roughly what the Lightning Dogs know.
Yeah,
and then everything else is not particularly important. But I would also like everything we've constructed to have like some notes of further details on Glampire. You know, like could have been this? He played an instrumental role in the downfall of humanity. These are all elements that should be hinted to, but never explicitly stated in any way, shape, or form.
More of the writer's guide as opposed to the story Bible, it seems.
Is there a difference? Because it's an internal document. We just happen to be making ours public.
Well, yeah. I mean, the writer's guide is the document that says, here's what we do, here's what we don't do. The series Bible is more of like a really big introductory thing. Especially for pitching a show, but the writer's Bible is the show is happening. We've already done episodes. Here's the tone for you who are not familiar and you're coming into the show. Here's what you need to know. The big do's and don'ts.
Well, wait a minute. So there's two kinds of Bibles now. This is news to me.
Well, no. It's not a different kind of Bible. It's just it's the writer's guide. It's the idea that you are a television writer. And
I've seen that as a piece of most of the story Bibles.
Well, you can do both. Like you can give somebody a story Bible and that might just be enough. But for other shows like The Next Generation or Star Trek Voyager, they have a writer's guide. Batman had a writer's guide. Uh-huh. That's the digital thing that we have. That is not something they use to pitch the show to get it made. That's something that after the show's already existed, they hand that to incoming writers or guest writers. Right. The writer's guide would be the one that says, we don't talk about Glampire's past.
You know, I never really thought that far along. I've always considered this to be an internal document for us writing Lightning Dogs. But at the same time, I've also talked about showing it to professionals and seeing...
Story Bible is quite literally what's going to sell the show.
But I always thought about it as a show pitch, which is simpler even than a story Bible.
Right.
Or they're going to want to see the Bible as well.
Well, it's all very loose interpretations. People have done mixtures of all three in different ways and... A writer's guide is way more in-depth, and it's more about the real minutiae of, okay, we're doing this, we're not doing this. This is definitely something in the background. This has already been established. We need to have a payoff for this. Story Bible is like the introductory thing. You've never heard of Lightning Dogs before. What do they need to know to say, I want to see that show? We don't need to tell them all about the fall of Earth. We just need to say, Earth has fallen. Glampire's in charge. They're going to figure out why. They're going to take back this planet in the name of the Masters. And he hints that he somehow may have had a hand in it. Yeah. This is what you need to know going into the first episode. And here are little notes about potentials of where it's going to go. For example, Angela is, the muscle. She gets her power is this. We do it like a little file. You know, it's like giving her, started doing. And then say what her temperament is like, what she doesn't like to talk about, which could lead to potential backstory stuff. Like she's sensitive when it comes to XYZ. Half of that would be just a glorious character design. Just something that's like full color, whatever. Just something that really sends it home. This is the definite final version of what is going to be in the show. Finer details of her background, how she grew up. Down the line, we bring in other people to help create the world of Lightning Dogs. That's when we'd have to let them know, okay, look, here's some of these other things that we had planned. But hey, we're a team of writers. Let's just see where we go with it.
I'm really excited for the prospect of seeing what other people whose work we're into, like developing based on this.
Right.
As well.
Because I think the thing that makes this work is the starting point that we chose. The Lightning Dogs on Earth fighting Glampire, and there's just endless potential on where to go with that. That is a great starting point. If we try and say, like, well, when's the starting point? Is it really when Glampire first decides to put money in an account? Like, no, that does not matter when it comes to the Lightning Dogs. So that's all just flavor for us because we already know so much about where everything is going to go. It is helping us kind of inform character decisions and character traits. But for anyone who's just coming into it, they don't really need to know all that.
I never thought we'd provide them with that much information, but more like if we truly know a lot about Glampire, that's a bio to inform everybody of his history.
Yeah.
I'd
rather the bio of Glampire be filled out, years from now by the fan who has watched every episode, read every comic book, and is like, well, we pieced together this, as opposed to an official release, this is the bio of Glampire, because that would give shit away.
I mean, it is true. Anything that we've talked about here could change drastically between now and the story Bible, and then even as the show's being produced, anything that hasn't actually occurred in any canonical release, any comic books, or if the universe is truly kind to us, animated content, we could change anything that hasn't been implicitly stated there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, heck, could even decide, you know, Glampire's a little too lame. We got to get a better bad guy. And then someone comes up with a bad guy and we're like, holy shit, that was perfect. How did we never think of that? Like, you never know.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to exploring the possibilities. I'm looking forward to creating new characters because we've been kicking around the same ones for a while for good reason. This is the baseline. This is the establishment. But I want to, you know, I want to get my hands dirty with like wacky side characters like Captain Right. Scrap and equivalents to Captain Scrap, not him specifically, because he's been around a long time.
Yeah, he's been around for a while. He's one of the first other side bad guys we thought of.
We should come back to the detail of the crystal array and the destruction.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because it does need to be large scale. It uh-huh. does need to rain down on the Earth. It does need to be a really cool visual in the instance that we do see it.
Mm-hmm.
All those things are true. It's mm-hmm. very important. It's super important to know absolutely everything we can about that instance because it will inform the evolution of Earth post-fall of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have to work with Glampire cannot know about the base with the Farfetch until...
Right, yeah.
Like, which is the trickiest part. Because if he had any play in the development of this technology, how would it even be possible for him to not know about it or to lose the coordinates to it or whatever? Because when Glampire says, how is there another one? Like, how is this under my nose this entire time?
Mm-hmm.
And then the dogs, like, he gets so excited and then the dogs take it away from him. Like, how does that happen?
I'd imagine that the Farfetch that they enter Earth on is somewhere underground. Like the idea that it is completely out of the way. And you could easily assume that even if he knew that there was a Farfetch in a building somewhere or in a military base far away, with the way that the world ended, you could easily assume that it's just gone. I mean, and he could just visit it and be like, yeah, there's no way. Maybe he was even there. Maybe he even saw the Farfetch and is like, yeah, this thing doesn't work. Like way back a several hundred years ago.
Well, I mean, it has to work because otherwise nothing can come through it.
That is the tricky part, because how does this technology work? Maybe each gate only goes to one specific gate. Maybe that gate only goes to Domus.
I think it could be reconfigured, but I think it's difficult because as we described it, the reason that they were able to open a portal to Domus and then build a stable counterpoint portal
mm-hmm.
On Domus itself is by virtue of those crystals latching on to other crystals out in the world.
Yeah.
So let's say they did that a couple times and they got one with a breathable atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
That was the trick. They're like, crank it open, stick a probe in, crank it open, stick a probe in. Nope, nope, nope. Logging those numbers though, like
yeah,
the
yeah.
details and all that. Oh, here's one with an atmosphere. It's harvestable. Now, what I think the best way we can work around this just for our own peace of mind and to validate the choices we're making with the story is based on the other governments and corporations in play during this time and what Glampire was branding the crystals as for his own purposes. Whatever he funded to build this array, what was it? Now, we know that the crystals conduct energy and that they can be used as a power source. They're very powerful. Right. They're weapons, they're energy.
Solves the energy crisis.
Right, solves the energy crisis. But there aren't enough of them mm-hmm. for there to be a crystal in every home, a crystal in every township or whatever.
And you wouldn't even necessarily need one. Like, if you just put a big enough crystal in a power plant 100 miles away, what's to say you couldn't just power most of the state? I mean, I don't want it to get too overpowered and too crazy, but we can shuffle some of the right. rules around to say, okay, well, they're powerful enough to do this, 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 and this, and you don't need to have a crystal in every home. You don't need to have a crystal in everything, because if you can erase all of the coal power plants
right.
or natural gas power plants and just use a crystal and hook those cables
but,
up to a single crystal.
But one single crystal will not do it.
Right.
It'll provide you clean energy for a long time, but only a little bit.
Right.
So they're not at a scale where they can make enough crystals to make that happen for every,
right.
you know, for
well,
every
it, well,
every city,
if
every country.
If they are growing them synthetically, it's a man-made crystal.
Right.
It's not naturally grown. You can grow them fast. You got to replace them fast.
Right, but it still is expensive and all. So here's my proposal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a combination of both you and I's suggestions, because my initial suggestion was that they were creating kind of like a wireless energy array,
mm-hmm.
that they would have a thing in orbit so that it could like wirelessly transfer energy. It's something that they're even working on right now with, believe it or not, collecting solar energy and then sending it back down to Earth as microwaves. I don't know, that doesn't sound safe, but it is a real thing that is being looked at as a viable source for better harnessing solar energy.
Hmm.
So let's say, okay, so what we can do is we can beam energy down to you. All your government corporations and everything, like, they can provide what they can provide. This is a temporary solution, but we can provide you with energy everywhere. You have to buy a receiver, plug that receiver into your home. It's an adapter or whatever. So this is Glampire's private corporation doing this. This is what he's selling. It could do that. However, that is not what he's actually built. It is actually like that space gate. He's preparing his own shuttle. He's got everything ready to go.
I see what you're getting at, but I think just making it about transportation, moving from one planet to another. Like, I mean, if that technology is made public, instead of it being like hiding the ball of like, oh, well, I'm really going to be doing this behind the scenes, but here we're doing this. But if it's instead is like, hey, in the span of about 20 years, humans have found crystal technology. We're growing it ourselves. We solved the energy crisis. We've even figured out that these crystals grow on other planets. And we found out that if you can tune them, you can find these other planets. And if these crystals grow on another planet, that usually means it may have an atmosphere because it needs it to grow.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we might be able to go to other planets without having to build spaceships. We might be able to go to another planet without having to have warp drive. We can go there instantly if we can just open up a gate to another planet. And this becomes a realistic possibility. And then they start small scale. Like you have one, you know, the size of like, you know, your bedroom wall. It's big enough to drive a car through, or maybe, you know, maybe a tank, you know, maybe, but it requires a lot of energy and the gate's only open for a short period of time. The smaller the gate is open, the longer it can stay open. It just consumes a lot of energy. And once the crystal's dead, it's dead. You got to go, you have to grow new ones in the lab, and it's a time consuming process, and it's a huge pain in the ass, but it is possible. So if you put enough crystals together, you can move something really big, really fast. And if he's trying to get somewhere that's super far away, say Glamrock or whatever the planet is, it's like, well, hey, I don't know if this is going way too far, but maybe he just openly says we've detected another planet, and it's actually his own planet. And that's his goal. He wants to find his home planet. And when they finally do, he's like, oh, man, this is so far away. We may never open up a portal to it because it's so far away and it's so difficult and blah, blah, blah. And he's just like, well, why don't we just throw everything we got at it? You know, why don't we just build an array in the sky and just try to send a single ship through? And then once someone goes through on a ship, they can build an array on that planet. So instead of like trying to build a doorway that you just walk through on Domus and you build a whole colony that way because it's small time, small energy, instead you try and throw everything you have at this other planet, and then you'll have a steady gateway, if that's making any sense. I feel like I've lost you.
No, you haven't. I've got kind of a tangential concept.
Mm-hmm.
If the technology to go to other planets is there, if he has achieved discovering, you know, where his planet is, why does he need to send a spaceship there? Why can't he just walk through a Farfetch and get to his planet?
Because there's no Farfetch built on that planet.
Well, right. But the idea I had was a possible solution for how humanity might deal with the instability of the end of a portal. Because if that portal sends you out there and there's any kind of fluctuation in that, it can attach to that other frequency again, but it might not even be in the same place. The planet might not even be in the same orbit. If you got dumped,
guaranteed to come through the same archway every time.
Right, right. Yeah. But if you showed up on the planet, that's fine. That portal will still go to the same planet, but it won't be the same point on the same planet.
Mm-hmm.
So a way that they could do that, and I'm going to use my hands here, and it's not going to be a good example for people at home, but imagine a Tesseract, the classic...
Imagine a Tesseract, okay. It's already hard enough.
the classic visual example of a Tesseract as presented in A Wrinkle in Time.
The three-dimensional version of a Tesseract.
Right. A piece of string held at two ends, and it's a straight line when you hold it taut, and then you fold it together, and the space, the wrinkle... happens in the middle where those two spaces are bridged, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So imagine, if you will, that the wrinkle is attached. So the two pieces of the string are brought together. The portal is open. At that point in time, the portal is open. The channel you can pass through. The Tesseract is made.
Mm-hmm.
If the portal that you've created to open this Tesseract in the first place has its counterpoint already built onto it,
mm-hmm.
like effectively one portal is two portals, mechanically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You can push the other portal through. So it's like, you know, open wide the field. The other half of the machine itself goes through. Maybe it's a more rudimentary one they got to like supply crystals to or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But so then.
And it builds it.
Right. So the other half of the portal becomes the ship by which people walk through to whatever land they've gone to.
Mm-hmm.
So then the string draws taut again. But on the other side, you have a fully formed mechanical portal entry on mm-hmm. one end. And now. A mechanical portal entry on the other end as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's the full mechanical version of the Tesseract. Otherwise, you're dealing with like wildly unstable transport.
Mm-hmm. And every time you turn it on, you just, they slam together. You step through the doorway.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It seems like the way it makes the most sense, you know, if we can come up with a visual dynamic, should we ever have to show this, of like them pushing a new portal through the end to the other opening. And it's difficult because, you know, like, I assume that this early crystal technology, it takes an entire room. So all kinds of stories to tell about the experiments that led to that one. But imagine, if you will, that the crystal technology exists, it's public. Well, there's no way in hell that once this technology is made public, other companies and governments will not attempt to use it also. Let's say that Glampire, who's leading this charge, he's like, for the first time in centuries, excited. He's like, oh my God, we can do it. We're going to do it now. I'm going to like finally get back. So he's obsessed. He's pushing things in directions they shouldn't go. He's encouraging them to cut corners because he doesn't even really understand the repercussions of it. He doesn't know just how bad it is. And even the people who are telling him, hey, this is like a little fuzzy, he's like, well, okay, that's fine. We can work with that. There's very few real disasters. There's nothing staring him in the face saying, you really shouldn't do this.
Right.
But meanwhile, there's other people who have taken his technology and maybe perfected it a bit better. So let's say the Domus operation is, let's say they're government and they're mining this resource. They're like, well, okay, so we've made landfall on other planets. We've explored the possibilities there. It's intriguing, fascinating stuff. It's being done bit by bit. Let's drill. Let's get these crystals. It's a good operation. I mean, basically, the crystals are a resource. The magnitude of going to another planet and colonize, sort of, that's a big thing. But it's either happening publicly, so everyone knows about it, which would seem hard for Glampire to miss, even just excavating the site to get the resources that were there, even if he deems it a lost cause. He would still take the time and manpower to excavate that site. It would have to be a secret. Not a forever secret, but like...
Maybe he did excavate it.
Yeah.
And maybe he did deem it a lost cause. But when the dogs over on Domus have finally evolved, they see a way through and they're like, hey, I think we can do this. I think there's an answer on the other side. It's not active, but I feel like if we sent, like, they send their version of a robot through. Right. Like, you know, like how when we are setting something up, they send their version through to establish a solid communication. And let's say the Diamond Dogs did that. That's why it's easy for the Lightning Dogs to come in.
Sure, yeah.
So for them, it's as simple as turning on a switch and then the Lightning Dogs go through. But the Diamond Dogs are the ones, the first team that went through that actually put that shit together. They refurbished the entire thing to make it work.
Which goes particularly well if we go by the suggestion that we had of the first team was mostly scientists. And of course, the Diamond Dogs, if kidnapped by Glampire, and if Glampire's got this full-blown thrall, he still didn't know where the Farfetch was. It must have been some kind of a battle that didn't end well, that ended with them like all being dumped into whatever like lobotomizing goop.
Yeah, like he couldn't get it out of them. So he turns them into the Diamond Dogs.
And he wouldn't have even, but they kind of like forced his hand. He was like, all right, enough of this. I'll track you back to where you came from. And it was in the process of doing that until the second team showed up.
Or maybe even when the Diamond Dogs first showed up, you got that interesting situation where they're talking to everybody. And they're like, are you a master? Are you whatever? And he's just like, oh, yeah. Like, maybe he actually has a dialogue with them when the Diamond Dogs first meet Glampire.
Right.
But when they realize shit's fucked up and they're trying to leave, he's like, let them leave. I want to see where they go. But they're smart enough to not lead him back to the Farfetch. They're like, we can never go back to the Farfetch because if he even has a hint of where it is, he's going to beat us there. We can't do it. So he eventually captures them, tortures them, tries to figure out where the Farfetch is. They tell him to go chase his own tail.
Right, but if they're legitimately in the same room with him, how could they resist?
I don't know. That's a good question.
What I was saying was that, like, whatever it is comes to blows so quickly that there's no going back from it.
I mean, they could let spill that they came through the Farfetch. And at first, Glampire's like, what are you talking about? The Farfetch? What is this? And I'm like, oh, it's this magical device that it's made of crystals and it allows the planets to connect. And he's like, go on. And they're just like, well, we came through one. He's like, you came through one here. And they're like, yeah. And then maybe one of them's just like, no, we said too much. Oh, shit. And like he tries to fight it and they just got to get away. I mean, we can say there's limits. Maybe the longer you're in his presence, the more susceptible you are. Or maybe if you have a weaker mind, you have less of a resistance. I don't know. We could say anything. Maybe you just don't like him. You know, like it's even though he's like, I got to admit it. The dude's magnetic, but I don't trust him. Or just one of them just has a keen sense. It doesn't smell right. It smells too good.
And we can give it a proximity effect. Even if you're...
Yeah, the closer you are. Yeah.
Right. And even if you're seeing him, you're like, wow, okay. And then someone's like, the way I'm feeling right now, good though it feels, is wrong. And like someone's like walking towards him. He's like, no. Like grabs that person, you know?
Yeah.
Bad dog. Do you feel comfortable with the implication that the Farfetch operation is publicly off the books
The one that goes to Domus,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't want them to say, we found a planet and we're going and we're bringing dogs. Like, that doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, let's say crystals are a way of life.
Yeah.
Whatever Glampire has in orbit there,
mm-hmm. I think that's public. And I think it's public knowledge that we can and have gone to other planets.
Yes. Yeah.
Especially if we're saying this is like a golden age for humanity.
Yeah.
We fucking did it. We made it.
We just haven't found the right one yet.
Yeah. We haven't found any other life out there, so we think. But we're going to keep looking. But in the meantime, we're getting more crystals, which will enable us to connect to other planets further down the line. Like playing telephone from this planet to this planet, we can skip across the universe in record time in a way that we never thought possible. It's a golden age. And then it all comes crashing down. So it's like if things are looking up technology-wise and culturally speaking, and everyone's aware that we've gone to the planets and the world's united and it's wonderful, and then kaboom.
You mentioned once about the possibility of Glampire trying to bring his army to Earth.
Yeah.
Which I think is still a bit too extreme. I don't think he's interested in invading Earth. He could have conquered Earth from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, unless his idea is, okay, look, I can't get back to the home planet yet. What I can do is bring my army to Earth, and if I enslave the population, then I can get back to Earth, because then I can focus everybody on building this shit with all the technology that I have. If he had the army that he had back on Glamrock, he could come to this planet and just wipe the floor in no time. He's got no question about that. I think, at least, that'd be interesting to me. But, yeah, him bringing an army like Loki is a little bit,
But just think about how he's gotten to this point in his life, and he isn't already the god of Earth. He could have presented himself as a god.
Well, he is killable.
Right. We don't actually know how yet. But he could have presented himself as a god.
Mm-hmm.
He chose not to. He's so strong. Yeah, he chose not to.
Maybe he did way back in the day, and they almost killed him. And he's like, well, I ain't doing that shit again. Like, when he first landed, I don't know if the people should be here or not. But maybe when he first landed, if he landed in ancient Greece or whatever, he's going to come off like some sort of god or demigod. And maybe people do worship him. But then it turns into the man who would be king. And then it's just like they suddenly realize he's not a god. He's something else. He's a monster. We got to kill him. And they almost do. And he's like, shit, I got to be careful because they almost killed me with sticks and swords.
I mean, what is his weakness?
Maybe just that he is killable. I mean, he's ageless, but he's not immortal. He's super strong. He's super tough, dense, like Angela, you could say, but you can hurt him. It takes a lot, but you can hurt him.
I find it hard to imagine that anybody with his power set of being able to sustain himself via absorption.
They just turned against him. People could just turn against him. If he tried, I'm not against the idea of him trying to make himself godlike or like king.
What about his thrall?
They may perish. That's the one thing about humans that he probably doesn't understand. He can control a group of people around him, but the people who are far away, who see their loved ones fleeing to this guy, and they're seeing the power that he's amassing, they're like, this is fucked up. Like, this is not right. We got to take a stand against this guy. We got to fight this guy. And look at all the people that he has working for him. And he doesn't give them anything. Like, they're starving to death. He's mistreating these people, and they love him. This is the devil. This is something evil is at work here. And we have to stop him. And he can't win over everybody all the time. Because, like, when he has a high profile like this, all it does is draw attention to himself. And since his area of effect is only so big, once someone has it set against you that they don't like you, and they're coming to knock down your door like, kill the beast, it's too late. You can't win them over in that short amount of time. And he may, you know, maybe there's an amazing battle sequence that we'll never see in film because it'd be too dark. It would just be where people start coming in and they're just hitting him and hitting him and hitting him. And he's grabbing this guy. You're dead. You're dead. You're dead. You're dead. And it's just not enough. They just overwhelm him. They put him in chains. They try and throw him into the bottom of the sea because they don't know how to kill him. But he escapes just barely.
Yeah. Okay.
Washes away somewhere else. And then he's like, I can't do that shit again.
Sounds epic enough. I'll buy it.
I mean, I'm again, he could fucking rule. He makes the Tower of Babel. I don't know. Like, he does something great, grand and amazing that we don't know.
The pyramids are shaped like the top of a crystal.
Yeah. the pyramid had a crystal at the top eventually at one point. It's capped on. And that's way too much into Stargate territory. But in real world history, there's civilizations that have risen and fallen that we don't know about. And we're only just now finding out about it.
Yeah.
Now imagine Glampire. I mean, the possibilities there are crazy, especially for someone who has that much sway over people. But if he doesn't take care of them, they're going to turn against him.
Why do people follow Glampire in the Lightning Dog's age?
He's the only person who can provide. I mean, if you're talking about the freaks.
He's smart. He's clever. He's got things locked down. I mean, like,
why do people follow Morden Joe in Fury Road?
Well, not all of them do. Like, right. Furiosa. Like, well, I'm saying we might need to show
Clue. I'm saying not everybody follows Glampire either.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we might need to show that.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I've always imagined there's other gangs out there. Like, there's other tribes out there while Glampire is King of Shit Mountain,
right? And, but he must provide for his people in some way. Otherwise,
yeah. I'm sure he does.
He wouldn't be this big guy.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. I'm sure he provides for them in some way. Like, look at Waterworld. The way Dennis Hopper provided for those people. Yeah, it was shitty, but it's better than sitting in a raft in the middle of Waterworld.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of room to play with there. Yeah. That's area that's still familiar and expected. Like, you can, you know, it's not like, wait a minute, why are they following that guy? I mean, that's. Because he gives them food and he gives them a purpose. Maybe he stopped civil wars that were happening with these freaks.
I mean, do you think that based on his longevity and his presence, did he shape this society as it's building itself up out of the muck? I mean, he definitely has, because based on the simple like landmass that he occupies and so on. But is this him in some ways taking responsibility for not having made more of his power? In some ways, like in the past, when he attempted to take power, he let humanity take that power from him. And he said, okay, I'll only hide in the shadows. So now he's out from the shadows. He's not masquerading as something he's not. He is truly himself for the first time ever. And is he the shepherd of this mutant flock? Is he,
I would say so,
responsible for these people?
I don't think he cares for them as much.
No, I don't mean cares for them, but is he responsible for them having structure enough to, like,
I would say yes. Yeah. I would say yes. Otherwise, why do they need him? Why follow him?
It's like, how long has he been doing this? How many generations?
Since the fall of man.
How many? Yeah, well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, how many generations of peopleoids have worshipped Glampire or have served Glampire? A lot.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's embedded in them. It's bred into them now. We're like, he's Glampire. We do everything he says. We love him. Because, I mean, if you from cradle to grave, you're in his presence, you fucking love that guy.
I would love to see a Glampire shrine.
In a hut somewhere. Lighting candles. These little the peopleoids are lighting candles. And just like.
And someone's got like, there's like a CD of like a Glampire CD. And like, they can't play it. Like, they don't even know what
it's
it is.
It's a shiny thing. It's a shiny object.
It's a shiny disc, but yeah. It's got this jewel case and it's got a picture of Glampire in it. And like.
And they stand it up. And kids they like, open it. Yeah.
What the fuck is this? You know? I don't know when we want to drop that bomb, but I would love to see the weird Santeria shrine to Glampire.
Right. They say there's an image of Glampire that's appeared in this village, and the light dies. We got to go fucking check it out. And it's just like a tree. And it's like, you see, he's in the bark there. You can see, it's he's there in the tree. And they're like, all right, we got to get out of here.
You know, he's a real guy. He's down the road.
Well, I mean, like they worship him. You know, it's like they think this little village has been touched by the will of Glampire.
Like, common people see him like as not necessarily an outright god, but like a saint among the living or something like that, like an empowered individual. Others see that he provides for some, but not for others. It depends on like...
Another Dennis Hopper movie, Apocalypse Now, with Marlon Brando over those people.
Yeah.
You know, just completely, what am I going to say about a man that he's a great man? He's a wise man. Bullshit, man. It's just like it's people who totally love him and they worship him, but not like as a literal god.
Yes. Yes, Apocalypse Now is just what we need. We just need to just siphon some blood from that film and imbibe it right in the Lightning Dogs.
Going out now to space, what are you gonna land on the moon? You gonna land on a one or a zero, man? Fuck that, man. Just like it's like numbers and shit. Like the people who you don't even know why you're excited about him, but you just are. Kind of like how we are in a weird way. He's kind of having that effect on us in terms of this fascination. What it's like if someone came in here, it's like, oh man, I heard you guys talking about Glampire and you really seem to love him. What can you tell me about Glampire? He's cool and he's got a presence, man. I can't explain it. You know, it's just it's interesting how that's art imitating real life. We've all agreed a lot on what he does, how he acts, how he is. But all of us have had very different ideas on what his visual design ultimately would take. I've seen pictures that Tony did. I saw pictures that you did. And I'm just like, I didn't think of that. You know, it's all been very different. And in my head, it's hard for me to explain. Basically, it's mostly been Jareth the Goblin King, I got to say. But I just had a different view, a little more glam rock.
My Glampire has always been 70s era Bowie. Mm-hmm. Like, I love Jareth, but Jareth is an extreme. mm-hmm. that we don't need to indulge.
I would argue otherwise, but I'm hearing you out. I hate to keep going back to Bowie, that it has to be what version of Bowie speaks best about glampire. Well, I mean, it doesn't, at the end of the day, it doesn't have to be any of them.
But specifically, like the glam rock era, like Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane kind of, with the intense costumes meant to evoke a man from outer space, but in a weird glam rock jumpsuit kind of way.
Overall, my vision of him was less man who fell to earth space traveler and a little more gothic, poofy sleeved, tight black pants.
Like a
medieval.
A vampire.
A little closer.
Straight up vampire.
Not ripping it directly from Castlevania or some shit, but definitely a step closer.
Alucard is what you want.
A step closer to Alucard and a step away from Ziggy Stardust. Although I like that version of, you know, the jumpsuit and the face painting and all that stuff. Like, that's fun. We can definitely have that. But on the whole, on the average, I always pictured it being a little more flowing robe, a little more flowy cape, regal. I never pictured something that you would see off the runway in Milan.
Uh-huh.
Like, it was something that would be maybe out there and strange, but definitely historical, whether it's alien historical or not. A little bit more Queen Amidala. You know, something that doesn't look like...
That's an extreme.
But what I mean by that is not literally taking Queen Amidala and just putting like that stuff on there, but something that looks like it's not making a fashion statement per se, and it's not art. He's not like... I never pictured him wearing artwork as much as he was wearing things that he thought was really fancy. Maybe it had a historical significance for the planet that he comes from.
Right, no, I see what you're saying, and I actually agree.
It's ornate, but not needless.
Right, it's not...
Without purpose.
It's not so designy that it seems like, why would he be troubling himself to have had someone make...
Right, because like, everything he wears, someone has to make. That's the thing. If you're in the wasteland, there's not a lot of resources. So for him to have like latex pants and like a leather jacket.
What you're saying is maybe gothic isn't the right one either, but perhaps a medieval level of ornate, a kind of complexity that's...
Or like feudal Japan a little bit, where it's like you have long flowing robes of gold.
Which
and
Bowie
stuff.
Is all about as well, so that's a good fit. But I suppose using high fashion clothing techniques from an earlier time to make something modern and strange looking, otherworldly.
Yes, especially because you're in a wasteland. You don't have, you know, designer clothes.
You know, he also needs to look interesting standing next to both Nagel and also, you know, Halloween Jack and Cap and Scrap and all that. Like, the way he looks has to evoke power. And then also to feel like when someone's looking at it on screen, like it's unified, like it's part of the same design.
I want you to take him seriously. The outfits can be outlandish, strange, exotic, colorful, all of that. But I don't want you to laugh at him. If you're like, what the fuck is he wearing now? Then it kind of deflates him a little bit. But if you're like, oh, he's extravagant, he's wearing this, but it still exudes a sense of power.
Right, and if he's got something that has that robey, flowy, capey kind of quality that you're talking about, it's got to be something that he can throw off. Like, he can toss cape aside.
To kick some ass,
like, yeah. And then like be like lean and fast and dangerous.
Yeah.
Or, conversely, he could also slip into some kind of gaudy but practical samurai armor and, you know, cut you to shreds or whatever. He's strong enough to still be fast and that kind of thing, too.
I'm picturing more... buttons, buckles, and belts, and less of zippers. I'm not 100% against zippers. I'm just saying that's a little hard to do, especially in the wasteland.
I mean, but then we got, you know, there's, for example, the greaser rockabilly stylings of Halloween Jack,
mm-hmm.
which is zipper-oriented. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, we could say, well...
But you can find that in the fucking garbage. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, that's fine. But when you're king of the wasteland, you're not going to get hand-me-downs. And whenever he's wearing something like a little trimmed down, like a jumpsuit per se, it can be colorful, but it's always slightly militaristic. I dare say Michael Jackson influence.
You know, when we were talking about it being constructed from things, I was thinking also Michael Jackson, because like his designers did such a great job of evoking a kind of Baroque element mm-hmm. to his, especially his 90s wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
Like one time he had a what looks sort of like a military jacket from a bygone era
mm-hmm.
where there were forks and knives dangling where medals would have been. Like
right,
it's kind
right.
of like, I mean, and it looked great.
Yeah.
Like it looked like it made sense. And only when you see a close up of it, you're like, that's silverware. What the fuck, dude?
Yeah. Right.
I don't think Glampire is going to like be like, yeah, adorn me in attractive junk.
No, yeah, but, of course not. That's something Halloween Jack might do where he's like, listen to me, I'm the general here. And I got, it's like, that's a fork. It's like,
instead of fringe on my jacket, I got cutlery.
Like, yeah, that's a spork, sir. That's like, that is not a medal of valor. Between Jackson and Bowie, I think we got a Glampire sensibility. Yeah. And it's weird to say Michael Jackson because you think some of the most iconic things he's worn has been zippers and buckles.
But I mean, he and Bowie have kind of competing wardrobes as far as like...
Maybe a little Prince in there too.
Variance, eccentricity. Yeah, Prince actually, early mid-80s era Prince, goes hand in hand with a lot of the stuff you were describing. I mean, because he was intentionally going for that Baroque stuff.
Yeah. Maybe a little Elton John?
No.
70s era?
Elton John has never...
Too much?
Ever.
Is that too over the top?
Yeah, no. I mean, like, he's always taken it too far.
That is part of the show, though. Yeah, considering. I don't mean our show. I mean his show. Elton
right,
John's
show. Yeah. There's Glampire.
Well, I didn't say Liberace. I said Elton John.
Well, Liberace is more believable. Elton John still went
you
too
think?
Far.
What the fucking... What the fuck? With the train running behind him? As long as the entire stage going up to his piano?
Not that part, but I mean, like, you know, the jackets and stuff. I mean, like, you know, the basic elements of Liberace's wardrobe makes more sense than a lot of the things that are representative of Elton John's wardrobe, though he did have to have some nice suits from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like, Elton John's like got a lot...
He wore big goofy hats and glasses.
Big goofy hats, big goofy jackets, big goofy shoes sometimes. Like, I love him.
No, but... I see what you're saying. It was more of a gimmick than the eccentricity of it. Like, it wasn't like, look at me, I'm being fashionable.
It was like Elton John's crazy outfits were kind of like a party guy.
Yeah, thing. Yeah. He was the carrot top of the 70s and 80s.
That's maybe not a good comparison.
Well, I was trying to say it's, he goes too much. It's comedic. He did it for comedic purposes. It was poking fun at that stuff. Probably poking fun at Liberace, to be honest. If he's another great piano player at the time, a great singer, and then it's like he's coming onto the scene and he's doing
maybe
this.
Maybe that's a context I hadn't considered. We're in a good place to really hammer home design for Glampire, but Glampire's one of those characters that, like, you know, the Lightning Dogs, they had a couple designs and we trimmed them up, and but we ultimately, like, they came to the world fully formed. We've always had a good idea of what they look like.
It was boiled down to the simple fun adventure. It happened very naturally.
I'm still really attached to the Eldon Terrell looking version of Cane Corso, and I'll keep fighting for it, but we'll see what happens. But with Glampire, I expect that he's going to be one of those characters, and deservingly so, that we're going to need to design a million versions of, because I want to see versions of Glampire that we haven't anticipated.
Let's look what we got. We definitely have more interesting avenues of Glampire's history that we didn't have before. Nothing that we know for a fact, like, did he ever really come to a rise of power and have people overthrow him? I don't know, but that's an interesting story, and I like it, and I think it fits, and it makes sense why he makes the decisions he makes. He definitely has control over the freak population. He's the one who, out of the ashes, they under his banner, he will lead them to civilization. You know, he will give them a purpose instead of just being freaks eating each other every day. Definitely got some powers listed down, making a threat, especially in one-on-one.
I mean, I think we have the definitive Glampire power set.
I hope this wasn't too much for the dear listener to endure. I
mean, you kidding? This is a really good one.
Yeah, yeah. We went pretty deep. Pretty deep in terms of Glampire, which I've been waiting to do. I've been waiting to dig into some Glampire.
I mean, I did not expect this to happen.
Yeah,
so
yeah. I figured it'd be a little lighter conversation starting about the, you know, the far-fetched technology and crystals
and
story Bibles, but it went to Glampire, which is great. So good. I'm glad we got that done.
Doug, what I'm feeling is we just need to write, which is tough because you and I both need to say, all right, I'm going to do this today no matter what, because there's no doubt a million other things that could come in front of it, but whether it's to fill in the backstory of a character we know about, just to put it on the page, to take all those little bullet pointed details and compress them into a narrative, the likes of which we've seen in so many summaries in these story Bibles, or to come up with something new, to follow a thought until it turns into something fully fleshed out. And then you can go to you or me, and be like Cap or Tony or local shop or anybody else working on the art staff. Like, I've got this crazy idea. Here's the words. Give me some designs.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I've learned anything from Lightning Dogs, legitimately, it's that there's no doubt. I mean, this seems obvious, but art inspires art. I mean, from us talking about it to people drawing their own pictures on the forums to a one sentence joke, Tony goes off and makes like four drawings. It's pretty cool how it can spread like that. But as of late, it's been sort of like, okay, there are so many directions to go in. We sort of are like, all right, well, what's next? Like, what's on the horizon? Like, back when it first started, it was cutting edge. I mean, you go back to listen to that first episode, these ideas are just like firecrackers, just sprouting off all in all these different directions. And now we're so far along, it's like, okay, we have this whole world laid out in front of us. Which direction are we going to go in? And it's easy to feel a little overwhelmed sometimes, but I guess I think you're right. I think it just comes down to us just being like, well, fuck it. We got to get back down to it. If it means we just got to start writing stuff, let's just start writing stuff and see what that inspires. Because it's going to be a domino effect once we get back into it full force. I mean, there's always progress that's made. I mean, every time we sit down and talk Lightning Dogs, I always walk away feeling like, yes, we've made some progress.
Yeah,
and I'm happy with the progress that we made.
We're just not doing it enough.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's just not frequent enough. At least not frequent enough to make any real dent in this crazy task that lies before us. But because we're serious about it, I mean, the raw potential is insane.
Yeah, no, we can't let this go by the wayside. This is important.
We're fans of the property too, you know? It's like we want to see it happen just as much as everyone else.
Yeah, we're gonna fight for it. It's gonna happen.
Creating Lightning Dogs in our spare time has been a real challenge. Between day jobs and all our duties keeping the Nerdy Show Network up and running, there's never enough hours in the day. But around this time, as the struggles of meeting up on a regular basis were really manifesting, we made some difficult life changes to begin the process of shaping our lives around Lightning Dogs. We changed the format of Nerdy Show, our flagship podcast, so that there was less work for Cap to do to keep it running. And as far as myself, I went to my job less, and that meant getting paid less. I couldn't manage it for too long, but it gave me a little extra precious time to invest in Lightning Dogs. A year and a half later, and the challenges are far from over, but we're constantly adjusting our lives to make sure that the fire for Lightning Dogs never dies down, and the project continues full speed ahead. As Cap has said, we're fighting for it, and we won't stop fighting until this dream is a reality. But you can join us in this fight. Head to patreon.com/lightningdogs and join the pack. We'll give you a shout out here on the show, offer a bunch of other perks like early episode releases and behind-the-scenes content. With your help, we're raising funds to continue to pay awesome concept artists, fund Greg Wiseman consulting our pitch Bible, and if we really band together, I'll be able to quit my day job and devote myself full-time to Lightning Dogs. If a dollar a month is still too much, then do the free thing. Rate and review us on iTunes. That's one of the best ways for Lightning Dogs to get discovered, but only if our ratings drastically increase in number. It's easy to do, and if you have any questions about how to do it, just head over to nerdyshow.com/spread the word, and we've got all the info you'll need. Now, in this episode, we covered a lot of ground for Glampire, and there's still more to come, including next episode where Tony weighs in on everything we've discussed here. Visually speaking, though, we are all over the place. But as you know, all of our core character designs are done. So if you want to see how Glampire ended up, you can skip ahead and see the final designs on this episode's page. We've only got one costume so far out of the many that we'll need, but we've got his look locked down. That design, along with all of his pre-evolutions, will be posted up in our DeviantArt gallery. If you dig what we do, don't be a stranger. Reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, the Nerdy Show forums, or wherever you hang out on the internet. We'll see you in 2 weeks with an all-new episode of Lightning Dogs, the official podcast. Ah!